Hi, everyone. This is The Takeaway. I'm Cindy Rodriguez from WNYC News, and I'm filling in for Tanzina Vega this week. We begin today's show with the life and legacy of Senator John McCain, who died on Saturday at the age of 81. Senator McCain was suffering from brain cancer. During an emotional speech last October, he said he was the luckiest man alive.
I have served America's cause, the cause of our security and the security of our friends, the cause of freedom and equal justice, all my adult life. I haven't always served it well. I haven't even always appreciated what I was serving. But among the few compensations of old age is the acuity of hindsight.
In the final pages of his last book, he wrote,
"The world is a fine place and worth the fighting for, and I hate very much to leave it," spoke my hero Robert Jordan, and for whom the bell tolls. And I do too. I hate to leave it, but I don't have a complaint. Not one. It's been quite a ride. I've known great passions, seen amazing wonders, fought in a war, and helped make a peace. I've lived very well, and I've been deprived of all comforts. I've been as lonely as a person can be, and I've enjoyed the company of heroes. I've suffered the deepest despair and experienced the highest exaltation. I made a small place for myself in the story of America and the history of my times.
Takeaway Friday host Amy Walter sat down with Fred Hyatt, editorial page editor at The Washington Post, to reflect on the legacy John McCain leaves behind.
I mean, there are a couple of kind of amazing things about traveling with Senator McCain. One is that unlike a lot of politicians in Washington who sort of gradually become less and less themselves the longer they spend in the public eye, you know, that never happened to him. He became more and more himself, and he was always a real person, and his personality never went away. And one of the things about his personality was he really cared about things very deeply, and he didn't hide it. And, of course, he cared a lot about U.S. leadership, and he cared a lot about leadership on behalf of values and especially on behalf of human rights and democracy and freedom. And he traveled around the world trying to promote those values and especially to corners of the world where a lot of American politicians don't go, where he thought people needed a little bit of a boost or a little spotlight because they were standing up for human rights against or in very difficult circumstances.
Were you with him in one of those places? Did you travel with him to one of those places?
I did a couple of places. He always tried to get people to go with him, including as many members of Congress as he could from both parties. Part of what he was doing was kind of being an example to the world without saying anything that, look, we're Republicans, we're Democrats, we disagree on a lot of things, but we work together, and here we are in Burma, or here we are in Serbia, and we care about these principles together, and we're working together, and it was kind of a model that didn't need explicating, that was very powerful for a lot of foreigners looking at it.
Do you think this is the role that John McCain always knew that he was going to play in the United States Senate, or do you think that this is the role that he decided he needed to play once he got there and sort of got more comfortable?
I mean, obviously, you know, at one time he thought he'd be playing this role from the White House. But I think especially as he saw presidents take the United States in directions that he thought were dangerous or counter to the way the United States should be leading, he grew into this role. And that started, you know, it was both Republican and Democratic presidents. He felt very strongly that Bush's strategy in Iraq was wrong. So, you know, he pushed very hard for the surge. And then he felt very strongly that President Obama was retrenching in a dangerous way and should have been more active in Syria in particular. And, of course, he felt double, triple strongly that Trump was taking the country in the wrong direction when it came to leadership and values. I think John McCain believed that you needed a president to provide leadership. Just recently, when President Trump went to Canada and insulted the allies there, John McCain tweeted, you know, this is not where the American people are. The American people believe in values, believe in our allies. At heart, the American people would support a more values-based leadership policy if somebody would take them seriously and make the case for it.
And that values base, there was a great deal that he pushed back, especially during the Bush administration, on torture, the issue of Guantanamo
Absolutely.
Bay. Is that part of the legacy? And how successful do you think he was in bringing that to the fore?
I mean, I think that is a huge part of his legacy because he really, I mean, you know, when Bush and Cheney and the first term Justice Department of the Bush folks, you know, started talking about and implementing what they called enhanced interrogation techniques, you know, for a few years, Congress was kind of just willing to go along with that. It was, you know, not long after 9/11, and people were scared, and it was like, well, we're dealing with something really new and dangerous, and, you know, we have to play dirty. I mean, that was kind of the mood, and it took John McCain pretty much single-handedly at the beginning standing up and saying, this is wrong, and it's not effective, but even if it were effective, it's wrong, it's not who this country is, and we shouldn't be doing it.
I know the use of torture compromises that which most distinguishes us from our enemies. Our belief that all people, even captured enemies, possess basic human rights, which are protected by international conventions the United States not only joined, but for the most part authored.
The fact that he had been tortured as a POW in Vietnam, which he, you know, he never made a big deal about during these arguments, but people knew that he had been tortured. People knew that, you know, he could have left that prison in Hanoi long before he did, but he refused their offer to let him go because he knew they were going to do it for propaganda purposes. That gave him the moral standing to make the case. And, you know, it took several years, and they really did eventually change the law. And that still stands. And I think a lot of that is thanks to John McCain.
You're right. And yet, the president, when he was then candidate Trump, said, well, you know, I don't think John McCain's a war hero because they don't get captured.
But Frank, let me get to it. He hit me. He's not a war hero.
He's a war hero.
He's a war hero.
5.5 years.
He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you.
Many of us, when we were watching that unfold, thought, well, there's the end of the Trump campaign. Everybody respects John McCain and his service to the country. And obviously that wasn't the case.
Look, for the moment, I think President Trump has captured the Republican Party, and it's standing for something very different than what John McCain stood for in his life. And the people who have tried to resist that capture, even if more timidly than John McCain tried to resist, people like Bob Corker or Jeff Flake are finding that they don't have a place in the party anymore. The bigger question of, you know, is this a turning point for the United States in the world? That's the $64,000 question. And, you know, I think our allies want to know. And you know, as John McCain would say, there are a lot of political prisoners whose names we've never heard of in sitting in prisons and Vietnam and Uganda and, you know, all over the world, who would like to know, is this the end of U.S. moral leadership, or is this a kind of strange interregnum and we will return to the role we've played under both Republican and Democratic presidents since World War II? I don't know the answer to that question, but I think it's something that people who care about democracy need to be fighting for.
One issue that he also was known for was immigration policy and immigration reform, which, once again, is not a very popular position on the Republican side. Is the fact that he was unable to really have success in getting the party and getting some substantive legislation moved on this a real disappointment?
It is a disappointment. It was a disappointment to him. He wrote his last book shortly before he died, and he spent a lot of time in it talking about immigrants, and he was very pointed about it. He said, you know, the great majority of unauthorized immigrants came here to find work and raise their families like most immigrants have throughout our history. They are not the rapists, killers, and drug dealers of fevered imaginations on the right. They're decent people working hard to make better lives. He's talking about the unauthorized, as some would say, illegal immigrants, and he's answering Trump.
You know, and yet, when he was under real threat in a primary a few years back, he famously ran an ad where he talked about, we got to build that dang wall.
Drug and human smuggling, home invasions, murder.
We're outmanned. Of all the illegals in America, more than half come through Arizona.
Have we got the right plan?
Plan's perfect. You bring troops, state, county, and local law enforcement together.
And complete the dang fence.
It'll work this time. Senator, you're one of us.
Right. So is this really at odds with that sentiment that he, when he's getting challenged from the right, he needed to be a hard line, no illegal immigrants coming in, I'm going to build that wall, versus these are really good, decent people. They deserve to be treated well and fairly.
You know, every time I wrote about John McCain, I would say he's not perfect. He's done things that disappoint me. And when he writes about himself, you can see he writes about the times he disappointed himself. What you just said is one example. There was the famous example of the Confederate flag in South Carolina in the primary when he was running for president. He said, I should have said it's wrong to be flying the Confederate flag. It shouldn't be on Capitol grounds. But during the primary, he wouldn't say that because he thought it would cost him too many votes. Mm-hmm. You know, and during his last Senate election, he tacked to the right. When he was running for president against Obama, he picked Sarah Palin for vice president. I mean, how could somebody who cares as much about national security as he said he did pick somebody as unqualified on that score as she was? You know, so I don't forget any of that, and I don't think any of us should. You know, you have to make compromises in politics. And could he have made fewer and survived in the Senate? I don't know. Could he have done better in the presidential race? If you know, there's a lot of what ifs. At the end, what I take away on immigration, for example, is he really did work hard with Democrats and Republicans to try and get a solution to the problem when there were a lot of other people in Congress who were more interested in using it for political purposes.
Fred Hyatt, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, this is Michelle. I'm calling from Nebraska. John McCain will always be the Republican that I could disagree with, but not be angry with. He was a true hero to our country, and I believe he thought out his opinions very well before bringing them to the floor. He will be missed.
Charlie Levinson from Vancouver, Washington. I give John McCain a thumbs up for his service to his nation and his thumbs down on repealing Obamacare.
Among all the other wonderful things people can say about John McCain, he was really a true public servant. We don't see that anymore. La Mesa, California.
For the military community, Senator John McCain carved out a special place in American history. That's especially true for veterans of war.
John McCain held a place of respect.
Bob Hesselbein is a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel who served as a helicopter pilot in the Vietnam War at the age of 19.
He demonstrated amazing courage as a prisoner of war in the Hanoi Hilton prison camp. He had the opportunity to return home to the United States earlier than his fellow prisoners, and he declined that because he wanted to demonstrate solidarity to those fellow prisoners who were suffering with him. And I think that put him a notch above just about everybody else. It takes exceptional courage under torture to remain in the environment when there's an escape. I think he came out of the fire of his experience with a deeper understanding and empathy for veterans.
I think one of the things that's distinct about Senator McCain and then also the relationship between, you know, veterans of the Vietnam War and veterans of the Iraq and Afghan wars is that, you know, those are our elders.
That's Elliot Ackerman. He's a novelist and a Marine Corps veteran who served in Iraq and Afghanistan.
As we went into having a wartime experience, you know, my understanding of what war was on my way to Iraq and then to Afghanistan was Vietnam. That was all I knew. That was what existed in our popular consciousness. And so having had those experiences, you know, I knew who Senator McCain was. I knew his story, and, you know, others like Jim Webb. And then when you finish the war and you come back and you're trying to sort out what coming back means, how you transition into this next portion of your life, you know, what sort of surprised me is, well, I guess you wind up looking to the same group of people. And how did they transition? And how did they go on to find meaning in their lives after the war? And I think as distinct as Senator McCain's war story is, his story after war is just as distinct in the way he was able to transition into a career in politics and to continue to serve and continue to find purpose in service.
You know, one thing the military teaches us is intense attachment to pragmatism.
That post-war story is one of bringing a military sensibility to the halls of the Senate. So says Kate Hendricks-Thomas, a researcher and Marine Corps veteran who also served in Iraq.
Doing things that work, not necessarily things that, you know, sound good or look good on paper. And I think back to his 2017 vote against the Affordable Care Act repeal. No. What he said was, this was hastily done in a completely not bipartisan fashion. I probably would vote for it if we made this important decision by pulling the stakeholders together and really talking about it and making a sound decision for the American people. But because we didn't do that, I'm willing to vote against the interests of my party and two of my best friends and be pragmatic. And that is something that military leadership values and prizes.
When it came to his campaigns, it was principles and issues over party and over personality.
Bob Hesselbein again.
I was never more proud of him during the presidential debate when an individual in the audience besmirched his opponent, basically saying he was a vile man.
I got to ask you a question. I do not believe in, I can't trust Obama. I have read about him, and he's an Arab. He is not. No, ma'am.
He's a decent family man, citizen that I just happen to have disagreements with on fundamental issues, and that's what this campaign is all about. He's not. Thank you.
In that rally back in 2008 lay some of the seeds of a movement that today has elected President Donald Trump. And though from the same party in name, the Republican Party of John McCain's days is far different from the one today being shaped by Trump. For Bob Hesselbein, a war veteran, it was a startling moment when, during the 2016 campaign, Trump called Senator McCain a loser and questioned his status as a war hero.
He's not a war hero.
He's a war hero.
He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you.
Well, I like candidates who don't dodge the draft through spurious medical excuses. I think that's probably all I'll say on that one.
For all the admiration many veterans hold for McCain today, the senator's political career was not free of regrets and mistakes, including his support for the Iraq War, which McCain himself reflected on in his memoir released this year.
I think the fact that Senator McCain is willing to sit there at the end of his career and write very candidly about what he thinks about, you know, decisions he made and his role in the prosecutions of wars is, you know, should be applauded. I mean, I don't think that in some way, you know, obviates the, you know, the service of all of the veterans who fought in Iraq. But, you know, I frankly feel better knowing that the people who sent me over there are at least reflective enough at the end of the day to say, okay, maybe I made the wrong decision. And for me, actually, I find some peace in knowing, well, you know, the person who sent me, even if it was a poor decision, was someone who at least at the end of their life is reflective enough to recognize that.
I feel that way myself. I served in Iraq thinking we're opening a front abroad. There are good reasons for doing this. And, you know, a decade later, I reflect on that and wonder, was it really an all citizen war? So I appreciate his reflectiveness. I also appreciate the fact that he very much had skin in the game. He has children that are in the military. He had a son that served in Iraq. So he wasn't a bystander pontificating on the conflict. I mean, it very much mattered to him as an involved citizen.
He was very much a hawk. And I was somewhat surprised at that after his own experience of war. And I think the painful reflection of recognizing the mistaken decision on his part is difficult when you've seen people die. If you're distant, if it's an abstract, it's probably a lot easier to throw a vote in one way or another to send the nation to war, support it. But when you've seen death firsthand, it should be more of a reflection. And I wonder if he regretted his vote.
Now, with McCain's death, there remains only one senator, Tom Carper of Delaware, who served in the Vietnam War. But there's hope, at least among these three veterans, that a new generation of political leaders from the military is on the way.
We do not have, at this moment, a crop of leaders like a Senator McCain, and we're losing them.
I think there's a real need and a real call for the next generation of veterans with this type of leadership experience and experience around the world to step up and to run for office.
I believe that we are in a resurgence of veterans re-engaging and seeking office. I have been very impressed by the last 8 years. And if you look at 2016, the young generation of veterans is moving forward to take their seat and their role. And I think John McCain would be very proud of that.
That was Bob Hesselbein, a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel who served as a helicopter pilot in Vietnam. Elliot Ackerman, a Marine Corps veteran who served in Iraq and Afghanistan and who's also a novelist. And Kate Hendricks-Thomas, a researcher and Marine Corps veteran who served in Iraq. All three reflected on the life and career of John McCain.
Peter Dumont calling from Berkeley, California. I will remember John McCain as an important man of decency, a leader with the inner humility, strength, and courage required to acknowledge, in respectful and even friendly terms, leaders from opposing political parties and positions.
This is Leslie from Audubon, New Jersey. As a lifelong Democrat, there are very few Republicans that I would speak highly of. John McCain was one of them. He was always fair, he was always honest, and he would accept, even if it was a Democratic thing, if he was interested, he would go ahead with it. So I think that's great. He crossed party lines. And the biggest was that he was honest.
This is Margot Ballard from Weatherford, Texas. I'm a 65-year-old, moderate, independent, had a lot of respect for John McCain until he brought the hate-mongering, divisive, and ignorant Sarah Palin out of Alaska. I'm afraid that colored my entire opinion for the rest of his life.
My name is Rick DeMays from Needham, Massachusetts. And I will remember John McCain as a true American hero and a politician who worked across party lines and, probably most important, a decent person in stark contrast to the current occupant of the White House.
The bell tolls for me. I knew it would, so I tried as best I could to stay a part of the main. I hope those who mourn my passing, and even those who don't, will celebrate, as I celebrate, a happy life lived in imperfect service to a country made of ideals whose continued success is the hope of the world. And I wish all of you great adventures, good company, and lives as lucky as mine.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
You have to understand, in spite of the theology of this country, that a kid is not born knowing what his color is. You know, kids are all finally the same. It wasn't that I discovered there were two colors in the world. It was the moment I discovered that no matter how many colors there are in the world, I was the wrong color.
That was literary giant James Baldwin on the Dick Cavett Show in 1971. Baldwin never had kids, but with 9 siblings, he had quite a few nieces and nephews. And in 1976, he wrote a book for them. Little Man was Uncle Jimmy's, as they called him, only children's book, published at a time when urban black and brown kids were rarely depicted in children's literature. At the time, the book didn't get all that much praise, but more than 40 years later, it's being reprinted and celebrated. Aisha Karifa Smart is an author and the niece of James Baldwin. She wrote the afterword for the republished edition of Little Man, Little Man. Aisha, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us, how did the idea to reprint this work come about?
Well, Professor Nicholas Boggs, who is one of the co-editors of the reissue, wrote about Little Man, Little Man. It was the subject of his thesis. And so it's been about 20 years since he set out to try and get the book republished. And even then, it took a long time for it to be finally picked up by a publisher, because still publishers were still a little afraid of it.
Really?
Yes.
What? So up until that point, had you thought about this book, Little Man, Little Man, in all of those years that had passed?
Not really. I mean, it was part of our collection, and we thought of it very much as our book. We knew that it was published, but I guess when we were younger, it never really hit us how large the audience could be and how many people could have read it. And so, you know, I was about 9 and TJ was 8 when the book was published. And so we didn't really think about it that much. I mean, we were delighted when we found out that Nicholas was so passionate about the book being reintroduced that we just thought it was a great idea, and even more grateful that he wanted to include us in the process.
And you said that the publishers were afraid of it still. So what do you mean by that?
Well, it's a different kind of children's book. In fact, I think my uncle grappled with what to call it. Is it a story of childhood? Is it a children's story? Is it a children's book? So because it deals with some adult themes, it takes place, the setting is Harlem, and TJ, my younger brother, is the protagonist, and he's a little boy who is growing up in an urban environment. The setting is Harlem, but it could be any urban environment in cities all throughout the USA, and he encounters, you know, some things that children who grow up in cities encounter, especially, you know, black children, black and brown children. So although he has a whimsical, fun, and carefree nature, and he's playing with his friends YT and Blinky, who I believe was inspired by me because I'm his oldest sister and I was his constant companion when we were kids, he sees some things, you know, people nodding off on heroin. There's the, you know, the idea of the police presence, you know, on the block and coming to arrest someone. And, you know, so there are these themes that are normally not associated with children's literature. So publishers weren't quite sure what to do with it.
And do you feel like it's really relevant right now, given everything that's happening when it comes to shootings by police, shootings of black men by police officers?
Well, black children by police officers, absolutely. I mean, it could definitely be used as a teaching tool, because the reality is, you know, children are not as unsophisticated as we believe them to be. And through the internet, you know, the advent of the internet, they're exposed to so much, you know, at a very early age. So I think Little Man, Little Man could be a wonderful teaching tool to young children about how some children grow up. This is a reality in America. This is a reality that we should not try to shield children from. And my uncle was very much a staunch realist. I feel like the time is now, and kids are definitely ready to be read a story like this by someone who can help them understand what my uncle was trying to depict, and also the fact that it was written in African-American vernacular, i.e. Black English, which he was a strong proponent of. It, in a way, he took ownership of it and said, this is the way we speak. And it's valuable, and it should be honored.
Right. And would you say that your uncle James Baldwin felt slightly uncomfortable or uncomfortable about this country's education system and how it affected young children?
Absolutely. I mean, he wrote another essay called A Talk to Teachers, and he also taught. And so he understood what it was like to be a Black child being taught by people who either despised him or didn't like him or thought he was inferior, and what is communicated to a child by someone teaching them that doesn't really value who they are, who doesn't look like them. So he was a strong proponent of preserving the self-esteem of Black children by teaching them about their history, about teaching them about the value of their lives and the value of the contributions of people who look like them. So absolutely, I would definitely say that he, as an educator himself, he taught at Amherst in his later years and was very much an advocate of educating Black children in a particular way that was reflective of their greatness and their excellence.
Aisha Karifa Smart is an author and the niece of James Baldwin. Aisha, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
The truth is, it's very hard to talk about education in this country without talking about the whole society in which it mainly fails to occur. Our children, therefore, are victims of this, the principles according to which the country is run. The country is not run according to the will of its citizens, I hope, but for profit. And education is a $1 billion industry. And the least important part of that industry is the child.
Last week, the North Carolina Historical Commission voted to keep three controversial Confederate statues standing at the state capitol in Raleigh. But in a move intended to show compromise, officials signaled a desire to see additional signage with historic facts and context in hopes of appeasing the concerns of those who find tributes to the Confederate slave state out of touch and disrespectful. The vote came in the same week that student protesters at the University of North Carolina's Chapel Hill campus toppled and destroyed Silent Sam, a Confederate monument that had drawn criticism for decades. Dr. Valerie Ann Johnson is a professor of women's studies at Bennett College in Greensboro, North Carolina, chair of the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission, and member of the North Carolina Historical Commission. And Maya Little is a doctoral student and organizer at UNC Chapel Hill. Dr. Johnson, Maya, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. So, Dr. Johnson, give us some backstory here. Confederate monuments have been in the headlines recently, but there's a deeper history in North Carolina. Can you tell me about some of the events that led up to this decision?
Well, we've had a series of questions from the community regarding the continued presence of, on the state capitol grounds, these Confederate monuments, or I call them memorials because they're more rightly memorials rather than monuments, in my opinion. These were memorials set out to inspire fear of whites for people of color, primarily. They were erected in order to remind people that this was white rule. And so, to me, they're objects of white supremacy. And out of that context, and because of what it occurred with the taking down of the Confederate flag in South Carolina and then subsequently the actions in Charlottesville, Governor Roy Cooper rightly asked us to weigh in and really recommend that they be removed. His idea was to remove them and put them in Benton Battlefield, which is not an unreasonable request in my mind.
Okay, so that's some of the backstory. take us to the resolution that passed last week by the North Carolina Historical Society. What were they trying to do and what was ultimately achieved?
Well, the idea was to, first of all, we had a study committee of 5 members. I was on the study committee with 4 other historical commissioners to see whether or not and to weigh in on whether or not the governor had the right to ask our body to remove the statues at Union Square, which is our state capitol grounds. So after the committee met, by consensus, 3 resolutions were drafted with input from the committee members, and then we voted on those. Again, it was a split decision. It came down to 3-4 leaving the statues in place, and 2 of us voted to have the statues removed.
So Maya, let's bring you into the conversation. How did you get involved protesting against Confederate monuments? And what does this movement mean to you?
I first got involved when I saw Silent Sam on campus, and I was interested and disgusted by this smirking armed Confederate memorial. When we talk about Silent Sam, there's been movements against Silent Sam since 1968. 50 years later, the statue was taken down. The community took action because our university administrators, the state government, has not responded, has not taken our safety and our dignity seriously.
What about the UNC leadership and political leaders who say, Maya, that to unlawfully destroy property is not the way to make change?
I mean, I think what's actually unlawful is the fact that administrators and lawmakers ask us to compromise on our humanity, to wait as white supremacists march on our campus, punch students, as happened on Saturday at UNC, are aggressive, make death threats, tell us they're going to hang us from the trees above Silent Sam. And to hear from our administrators and from city officials and state officials, just wait, go through the legal processes to ask us to compromise on our humanity, to ask us not to defend our community from white supremacy is, in my eyes, very unlawful and dangerous.
Dr. Johnson, let me let you have the last word. Where do you see this going, and what does recontextualizing mean to you, and how will it happen?
So first of all, I just wanted to give my admiration to Myra Little concerning her actions, and I understand the frustration because people have been waiting a long time for these things to come down, and I do commend the students for taking them upon themselves to force an action, to force an issue. Recontextualization is not really, to me, a possibility in the times that we have right now. And I say it because you can put a small plaque up that would talk about civil rights, maybe, or talk about the enslavement of African Americans, but those statues are large. One of them stands 75 feet high. How do you create an interpretive moment, an interpretive piece around something that large, that imposing on the state capitol grounds? And that is why there has been, and I'm glad Maya brought this up, the continued resistance to these beacons of white supremacy and fascism. So whether or not we can recontextualize them, the attempt will be made. This is not a completed process by any means. We still have a lot of work that needs to be done. And I would rather it be done people working together and working across both sides of the aisle. But as rightly pointed out, I don't see that at this particular time right now. And so this is something that I think will be in contest for quite a long time.
Dr. Johnson, Maya, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you.
Dr. Valerie Ann Johnson is professor of women's studies at Bennett College in Greensboro, North Carolina, chair of the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission, and member of the North Carolina Historical Commission. And Maya Little is a doctoral student and organizer at UNC Chapel Hill. And that's our show for today. Thanks for being with me here on my first day filling in for Tanzina. I'll be with you the next 2 days on the podcast. Remember, you can always talk to us at our Facebook page or on the phone at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're always looking for you to be involved. You can tweet me also at Cynrod, C-Y-N-R-O-D. I'm Cindy Rodriguez, and this is The Takeaway. Talk with you tomorrow.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.